Ready to proceed?
We are, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Louis Rizzo. I represent Appellant Travelers Insurance Company. With me today is Brian Kasperzak of the Marks O'Neill Firm in Wilmington, representing Stonewall Insurance.
Morning.
It's my pleasure to introduce to the Court Robert Johnson of the Sun and Shine Firm in Chicago and his associate, Keith Moskowitz. Mr. Johnson has been admitted pro hac vice in this case and will be presenting the argument today on behalf of the appellants.
Welcome, counsel.
Morning. May it please the Court. Richard Horwitz from Potter Anderson Caroon on behalf of appellee DuPont. With me at counsel table, and I'd like to introduce them, John Sylvester from Kirkpatrick Lockhart, Preston, Gates, and Ellis. Also Clarence Dozier, an associate in that firm, and then from DuPont, David Burt, in-house counsel at DuPont. And Mr. Sylvester will be making the argument for our
Welcome. Firm. You ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
May it please the Court. We'll reserve 5 minutes of time for our rebuttal. The primary issue on this appeal, Your Honors, is whether DuPont must incur only one $50 million self-insured retention in the 1985 year, or whether DuPont must incur two such retentions, one in the 1985 year and one in the post-1986 policy period, because DuPont sought and received insurance coverage in that post-1986 policy period.
Let me start at the beginning. Why only one retention for the post-1986 period? Why not a retention for each year in the post-1986 period?
As I understand it, they were claims-made coverages that were issued by XL and ACE. They were a combination of claims-made and occurrence-based policies. When they tendered the coverage to XL, there was a particular coverage that applied, a particular policy. And then when they subsequently, a couple of years later, when the claims started to mount and they had exhausted the XL policy limits, there was a separate policy that applied with regard to a one-year limit with regard to the ACE coverage. So in effect, they are required to take one SIR in the post-1986 period. We don't contend that they need to take more than one. In 2002, the Superior Court ruled that DuPont would have to incur a separate $50 million SIR in each year in which it seeks insurance coverage proceeds for the claims and expenses that it had paid in connection with the underlying polybutylene pipe litigation. The Court's ruling was based on the structure of DuPont's insurance program, a rather unique structure. DuPont structured its coverage so that it would be self-insured for $50 million in each policy period, with insurance coverage provided above the SIR only in the event of a catastrophic loss or claims. The Superior Court's ruling in 2004 is not at issue on this appeal. DuPont actually initially sought an interlocutory appeal from it, but then decided to dismiss that appeal, and instead of pursuing its appeal, DuPont took the position in the Superior Court that it is not legally obligated to incur two SARs, even though it had sought coverage from two separate policy periods, because the coverage it sought in one of those two periods, 1986, it obtained not through litigation, but through agreements with the post-86 carriers, who were, in effect, were XL and ACE. The Superior Court agreed with DuPont, holding that its 2004 ruling only applied to situations in which there had been a litigation to judgment in multiple periods. But there is absolutely no support in the law with regard to this litigation to judgment limitation that was adopted by the Superior Court. In fact, it was an argument that DuPont made up out of whole cloth. There is no case law anywhere that supports it. And furthermore, in this particular case, the litigation to judgment limitation is wholly inequitable under the facts of this particular case, because all of the claims against DuPont do not fall within any one policy period. So DuPont needs to trigger. It needs to trigger two separate policy periods, at the very least, in order to get sufficient coverage for all of its claims. Therefore, if it needs to trigger two separate policy periods, we contend that it must pay two separate $50 million SIRs. Let me explain why they need to trigger two separate policies. DuPont started selling the acetyl resin at issue in this case, which is called Delrin, in 1983. Its sales of that product span the years, from 1983 to 1989, and the PB systems, the polybutylene systems, were installed over that same time period, 83 to 89. Of all of those installations of systems that had Delrin in them, 55.6% of them are in 1986 or thereafter. Therefore, those installations in 1986 or thereafter do not trigger the 1985 policy year. That's because the 1985 policies that Travers, my client, and Stonewall issue only provide coverage for property damage that occurs during the policy period. So naturally, installations that occurred after 1986 would not cause property damage until 1986 or some subsequent date. They do not trigger the 1985 policy period. Accordingly, the Travers and Stonewall policies do not provide coverage for any for 1986 installations or any installations thereafter. Therefore, in order to obtain coverage for more than one half of the PB claims that it had paid, DuPont was required to tender those PB claims to its post-1986 carriers, XL and ACE. And that's exactly what DuPont did. In 1995, DuPont tendered about $71 million of PB claims to XL, which is the carrier that sat above its $50 million retention. And it sought, after the payment of its $50 million SIR, it sought about $20 million in coverage from XL. That was what happened initially. Thereafter, in 1998, after the claims had continued to mount, and after XL had agreed to pay $67.5 million off of its $75 million in limits, DuPont tendered $179 million in claims to ACE, whose coverage sits above XL's. DuPont sought indemnity from ACE for claims that fell within the post-1986 coverage period that exceeded the $50 million SIR in the post-1986 period and the $75 million in underlying coverage that XL provided. What is crucial to understand is that the ACE agreement is a coverage in place agreement, and it expressly requires DuPont to exhaust all of the underlying limits, and those underlying limits, again, included the $50 million SIR and the $75 million XL policy. It required exhaustion before ACE was required contractually to pay any amounts at all. And what ACE and DuPont also did in that agreement is that they agreed that 75% of all of the damages arising from all of the PB claims shall be deemed to be allocable to the post-1986 policy period, and that DuPont could use 75% of those claims to exhaust its underlying limits, and that's exactly what it did. 75% of those claims were used to exhaust the $125 million in underlying limits, which consisted of the $50 million SIR and the $75 million in XL limits. And it was only after that that ACE began paying. The ACE coverage in place agreement tracks the conditions and requirements that DuPont had to satisfy in its ACE policy. Those conditions included the exhaustion of the underlying limits before ACE had to pay $1.
Just one point of clarification. Even though DuPont gave the credit for 75, only $67 million was paid. Is that correct?
Correct. Only $67.5 million was paid by Xcel. What Xcel did is that they agreed to make an accelerated payment. There weren't $75 million in claims that they were facing at that time. They presumed that they were going to have to pay $75 million eventually under their limits, and they got what appears to be a discount because they made an accelerated payment. ACE has paid and continues to pay PB claims allocated to the post-1986 period on an ongoing basis, but it has done this predicated upon DuPont having satisfied the underlying self-insurance retention and the excess insurance limits that were set forth in the Xcel policy. Now, in this case, DuPont is also seeking coverage under the 1985 policy year, and it's seeking coverage from Stonewall and Travers. But it can only obtain that coverage, we submit, after it incurs, obviously, the $50 million SIR that sits under our policies, as well as the $50 million SIR that it was contractually obligated to exhaust with other claims in the post-1986 period. And it was contractually required to do that under the ACE agreement. There is no question, Your Honors, that under the Superior Court's 2004 ruling, DuPont would have to have incurred two SIRs if it had litigated its coverage to judgment against both the 1985 carriers and the post-86 carriers. The fact that DuPont entered into a coverage agreement with these carriers in post-86 instead of having litigated against them is not a principal basis for holding that DuPont need not incur a separate $50 million SIR in 1986.
But aren't you just really complaining about the fact that your client's year was chosen as the policy year for these purposes?
Well, we would have preferred, obviously, some other year, Your Honor. In fact, they initially targeted the 1983 year, and it was only after the court issued its 2004 ruling that they turned around and decided to target the 1985 year instead. But what they have done, they can't get all their coverage out of the 1985 year. If they could get all of their coverage out of the 1985 year and didn't have to go to the post-86 year, then they'd be entitled to take one SIR. But as I said, 55.6% of the claims don't even trigger our policy period. They trigger the subsequent policy period. And because of that, their structure was that they would have to take a $50 million SIR in each of the policy years for which it is seeking coverage. And indeed, that's exactly what the 2004 ruling holds, is that they have to take a $50 million self-insured retention in every single one of the policies in which they seek coverage. Now, DuPont contends that what we are arguing means that any time it settles with the carrier, let's say it settles with the carrier in 1983, DuPont would be required to incur another $50 million SIR in that year. But that's not what we're contending. As we stated in the reply brief, we are asking this court to adopt only a narrower holding, one that is based on the specific facts of this case in which DuPont was required contractually to exhaust its SIR in order to obtain coverage in the post-1986 period. We only ask that the court rule that agreed allocations to a settlement period bind the policyholder in subsequent dealings with insurers in other years where the policyholder has accessed coverage in the settlement period by negotiating an agreement that allocates amounts to the settlement period for the purpose of first exhausting any self-insured retentions and underlying limits, and then for payment of the payment by the settling insured. That is exactly what DuPont did in this case with regard to its agreement with ACE. As I noted,
Is there anything in the policy between your client and DuPont that requires that? Are you simply saying, well, because there's a contractual relationship with other insurers, we get the benefit of that agreement?
That's exactly what we're saying, is the latter. There is nothing that is in our policy that specifically requires them to exhaust an SIR in a subsequent year.
Isn't that really what the problem is? That perhaps the people who drafted your policies in retrospect could have done a different job, and it's your language and you're just stuck with it?
Well, I don't believe that that is the case, Your Honor. The bottom line is that they are required to, by the structure that they had set up, take a $50 million SIR in each year. The court held that they have to take a $50 million SIR in each year. But then the court held in a subsequent period that, well, that rule, although that rule applies across the board, he said, well, it only applies in situations in which you litigate the coverage to judgment, not in a situation in which the coverage is settled. And we say that there's no principled reason.
Well, you were talking about the settlement in this contract. I don't want to take up your time with a long hypothetical. My question, I think, is simple. Let's suppose in the settlement DuPont had used whatever language it could have used and basically said, this is without prejudice to our rights to make the 1985 claim, basically trying to contract away the argument you're making here. Could they have done that effectively?
If the subsequent, what we're saying, Your Honor, is that if the settlement agreement that's entered into doesn't require exhaustion, if it's a lump sum payment, and, I mean, they use the example in their brief of GEICO, which was a high excess carrier in 1983, it settled for some unknown amount because they haven't told us the amounts of any of the 83 and 84 settlements. We're not contending that there has to be an SIR taken in that particular year because that apparently is not what the, we haven't seen the contract yet, but we presume that that contract that they entered into with GEICO doesn't require underlying exhaustion. But that's not the case with regard to the ACE.
Even in that situation, you still would get a credit.
We do get a settlement credit for any amounts that they bring in, and that's not contested.
Okay. So you're into your rebuttal time. As I said, I didn't want to take up your time.
All right. I will. I appreciate that. I will save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to begin my argument by noting this Court's prior enunciation of Delaware public policy in the case of Nottingham Partners versus Dana for Mr. Justice Holland, when the Court enunciated that as a general proposition, Delaware law favors voluntary settlements of contested issues. And that's really, that fundamental concept of Delaware public policy is really what this appeal is about. President Judge Bond studied the facts of this case and thoroughly analyzed them and understood Delaware public policy when he ruled that non-settling insurers, such as Travelers and Stonewall, the 1985 insurers, would receive a credit for amounts actually received by DuPont from settling insurers in other years who had overlapping coverage responsibility, but they wouldn't get the extra credit, the extra amount of discount that the 1985 insurers are seeking. Judge Vaughn's ruling was certainly fair to all the parties. It encourages early settlements, promotes early settlements, and by contrast, the rule that is being proposed here by the 1985 insurers would create huge disincentives for insurers to settle and would make settlement of these complex, multi-year, multi-party insurance disputes very, very difficult.
Could you just address the last exchange we were having with your opponent, which seems to suggest that if there had been a lump sum settlement without specific details, we wouldn't be here. But because the nature of the settlement acknowledged a credit for the SIR in the post-86 years, that basically that's an issue in this case.
Yes, Justice Holland, I will. And I should say that the entire premise of the 1985 insurers' argument in their proposed rule is based on a mischaracterization of our agreements with the post-86 insurers. In essence, what we had with both XL and ACE is a lump sum settlement for the most part. They keep focusing on an interim initial ACE agreement that we had under which they began initial funding and later subject to a final agreement, which was essentially a lump sum buyout for most of the coverage obligation.
That was the 67 rather than the 75.
It was the...
With XL.
Well, no, I'm talking about the 2005 ACE agreement, which voided and superseded the 1998 ACE agreement, which was an initial agreement. Under that agreement, ACE never agreed that it would, the parties never agreed that we would allocate 75% of the losses on a permanent and binding basis to the post-86 period, and that they would pay coverage without reservation. They agreed to provide initial funding on a 75% basis as an initial matter. We had to pay them back as part of that agreement under the loss stabilization, 11% of what they were paying us. And so it never was 75% to begin with. It was about 67%. And then subsequently in 2005, after we continued to have coverage disputes with ACE, because they always maintained throughout this period that they were paying, that they had the right to get their money back. They had the right to assert their coverage defenses. We just agreed they would pay money while we saw how the claims experience developed and then settle up later. We settled up in 2005, voided that initial agreement, and we settled up that they would pay $41.5 million on account of all of the liabilities that DuPont had incurred through the end of 2004. And we gave them a release in exchange for that. That was, in essence, a lump sum buyout deal, just like the Excel agreement where they paid $67.5 out of their $75 million worth of limits. Now, ACE did agree as part of that 2005 agreement that on a going forward basis, they would pay either 50 or 60% reimbursement depending on the nature of the claims and the liabilities that DuPont incurred. And so this notion that we have this final and binding coverage in place agreement with ACE where we all agreed that 75% of the claims would be slotted in the post-86 period is just fiction. It is not in the record, and if you look at the settlement agreements, as President Judge Bond did, he understood that. And so this whole rule that they're proposing about, which they now in their reply brief limit only to coverage in place agreements, which are undefined, it doesn't apply to our case because we didn't have a coverage in place agreement. We don't have a coverage in place agreement under the normal sense of a coverage in place agreement where an insurer in the ordinary course agrees that it has coverage responsibility, agrees that it will pay subject to underlying limits without reservation. That simply was not the case with the post-86 insurers. All of these settlements are hotly contested resolutions of in a business manner of highly contested disputes on coverage. And the notion that they just willingly were paying us 75% on a 75% basis is just false. And so
Help me with a notion that I'm struggling with, that we're being asked to set some rules for a game theory exercise almost, that you sit back and you try to figure out how to game it. There's some perverse incentives that are being created here. You talk about the incentive to settle. Well, there's a tremendous disincentive to be the last man standing. I think we can all agree on that. But are we setting up too harsh a penalty for not coming forth and settling?
Absolutely not. If you look at the situation of the 1985 insurers, based on the credits that they'll get from the settlements that we do have, only $126 million is now being slotted in the 85 year, when in fact, if we had settled with nobody, we could put $146 million in the 1985 year, because that's their share, the 45% of all the claims dollars, and then 100% share of the indivisible litigation costs. So they're getting a benefit by virtue of our settlements with the other insurers. And so their complaint that they're that somehow we're doing better than if we litigated against everybody equally applies to them. They're doing better than if we litigated against everybody. But what their rule is that if you have certain kinds of undefined coverage in place agreements, and again, because they only put it in the reply brief, it's hard to address it because they never defined exactly what a coverage in place agreement is that would apply under their rule, that you get the benefit if you're a non-settling insurer in another year that has overlapping coverage obligation. You get the benefit not only of the amounts being paid by the settling insurer, but also amounts of the entire amount of the underlying limits and presumably the entire amount of limits of the settling insurer's policy that aren't being paid. That's what they're arguing with regard to the XL settlement, that they get the benefit of the $7.5 million that Xcel didn't pay of its limits. And so their rule creates such huge incentives for an insurer to wait and sit back and let other insurers in other years pay and give them substantial credits. And if all of the insurers are waiting for the others to settle, that's going to create a huge problem in trying to settle these cases. Plus, if you're a policyholder like DuPont, where you're trying to structure settlements and get together a settlement pot that hopefully will make you satisfied to end the litigation, you have to be extremely wary of making any settlement with any insurer for less than 100% of its limits, because every dollar that you give up from the limits of a settling insurer, you can't now recover from an insurer who has overlapping coverage obligation in another year. And so you're going to be sacrificing significantly under their rule, and that, again, is not a good recipe for settlement.
But I always thought compromise was when I gave something up. Here, what DuPont did was, at least under your theory, is it gave up somebody else's money, and DuPont doesn't give anything away for having settled for 67 instead of $75 million.
Well, that's the situation that we have, fortunately, where we have overlapping coverage obligations, where if this was a situation where we could only put claims to 1 year, obviously we have the compromise and the sacrifice of whatever amount less than limits we accept. Here, under the all sums ruling of this court in Hercules, we have a situation where we have multiple years that are triggered by the same occurrence. And therefore, we can choose the year that we seek to go to get coverage. And again, as you noted, Vice Chancellor Noble, what their real complaint is that we're picking their year and we're making them honor their contractual obligation, and they're not getting the benefit of some sort of pro rata allocation that they might otherwise like. If they think that they're being disproportionately put upon, then after they make the policyholder whole, then they can make their claim for contribution against any other insurer and seek to recoup some amount if they think they have a legitimate theory. And that's what this court held in the Monsanto case, and that's their option after they make the policyholder whole. So,
is this case really a proper vehicle for announcing a general rule? It seems the way you're arguing that it's pretty clear if you go to judgment in two separate years how things would operate. But to the extent you ever have a settlement, the implications are going to turn on the particular nature of that settlement.
I think that's right. I think the general rule that they're proposing, first of all, is so vague and ambiguous, I'm not sure how it would be applied because they don't define what they mean by a coverage in place agreement. But secondly, here, President Judge Vaughn looked at all of the facts and the circumstances, analyzed what their coverage obligation under their policies, under their contractual agreement, would be in the absence of settlement, and that is we could put $146 million of our liabilities of the 236 into their year and determined that there was nothing unfair about a situation where they get credit for amounts paid by settling insurers and therefore reducing that down to $126 million. There was nothing unfair to them, and they were simply being held to their contract. I think Mr. Johnson conceded that there's nothing in their contract with DuPont that gives them the right to get this extra credit or set-off that they're now asking for. They are just asking for the court, you know, under a sense of equity, under their vision of equity, to give them some relief from their contractual obligation. And that simply is not fair to DuPont because we have a contract with them. We want to hold them to their contract. I want to
stated differently. Your argument is DuPont should not be penalized for settling, and they're saying that they're being penalized because you did settle.
We're saying we should not be penalized for settling, that we still have a litigation that we can pursue against them for the joint and several liability that they have for the $146 million of claims and dollars that we can put to their year. And they think that they're being penalized, although, again, I'll repeat that under President Judge Vaughn's ruling, $20 million less is being slotted in their year than would otherwise be the case had we had no settlements with anybody. And
but
so
they want the other $30 million if you have to account for the $50 million.
That's right. They want us to have to eat another $50 million because we settled with insurers in another year. Similarly, we settled with an insurer in the 1983 year or the 1984 year. Presumably, they want us to have to bear another $50 million SIR for each of those settlements. If we take $1 million from a high-level excess insurer in some other year, then under their logic, and they haven't shown any logical distinction between a lump sum agreement and a coverage in place agreement where there are payments over time, but under their logic, we'd have to bear 50 or 100 or whatever the amount of underlying limits are with the settling insurer on a theory that we couldn't have gotten to that settling insurer's layer unless we had allocated that number of dollars worth of claims liabilities to their year, and therefore we have to assume that you did before you collected your $1 million from the excess insurer at the high level. That creates such huge disincentives for a policyholder to settle. I mean, the reality is, in these kinds of cases, and I've handled many and many of them and settled many of them, is that when you have a multi-year, multi-insurer, complex insurance coverage case, you settle with a number of bilateral agreements that you do with all of the different insurers, each one viewing their own exposure and what their worst-case scenario is, the policyholder making compromises as it must, and you try to put together a settlement pot that will make, if not everybody happy, everybody equally unhappy, and then the litigation ends. If we have a situation where there's huge penalties in settling with insurers for less than their limits, then it's going to make settling these cases extremely, extremely difficult, and there's no basis in the policy language to support such a rule. And so because it's so contrary to public policy and because it's inconsistent with the policy language and with the law, the law of Delaware as enunciated in the Hercules decision, there's no reason to adopt the rule. Plus, as I said, I think the rule is really an advisory opinion because it doesn't even apply in this case given the nature of our settlements with the post-86 insurers. I'd like to use the rest of my time to address the other two issues briefly, if I could, that have been raised on appeal. The second issue that they raised was the so-called divisibility of the litigation costs, the $74 million worth of litigation costs that we, DuPont, incurred in connection with this case that President Judge Bond said were the joint and several obligation of any of the years, and therefore we're assigning them to the 1985 year. As to those, they break up into several different categories. As to $42 million of just general defense costs, there's no argument that they should be allocated among in the same proportion as the claimants who have been paid who have received relief under the class action settlement, which is what the proposal is. The litigation costs were incurred in connection with a whole host of different lawsuits, 200 or so, as noted by President Judge Vaughn in his opinion. And the notion that somehow those costs are in any proportion to the claims who have been given relief under the settlement agreement is just pure fiction. And again, it's another thing that they're making up out of whole cloth and asking to impart into the policies when there's no language to suggest that. Their policy language says that they pay all sums with regard to claims that trigger their policy period, and all sums includes defense costs. The burden was on them to show divisibility of any of these defense costs, and they were never able to show at the trial court level that there was any amount that we spent that was solely attributable to the post-86 claims, such that if we didn't have the post-86 claims, those amounts would not have been incurred, and therefore they shouldn't have to pay for them. They had the burden to prove that. There's no evidence in the record. They didn't adduce any evidence in the record to show that, and they should be held to that failure of proof. Secondly, with regard to the costs that we incurred in paying plaintiffs' counsel fees and notice costs of the Spencer class action, they cite some cases in their brief which say that in certain cases plaintiffs are assigned the task of paying for either notice or paying their counsel fees. In those cases, first of all, they don't always necessarily say what they suggest that they say, some of them just distinguish between named plaintiffs and the rest of the class. But the fact of the matter is that's not our case. In our case, as part of the settlement, DuPont was obligated to pay the plaintiff counsel fees in a lump sum and pay for all the notice costs. We were paying it as part of our settlement. The settlement was we pay those amounts and we also contribute to a settlement facility that replumbs all of these claimants who have polybutylene pipe systems with leaking parts. And because it was our indivisible expense, President Judge Vaughn found that it shouldn't be allocated as among any particular group of claims or subgroup of claims, i.e. the paid claims. And so their case law is completely inapposite to our situation. And then finally, on the third issue, that is the so-called pre-1983 claims, they've argued on appeal that there's a genuine issue of fact now that precludes President Judge Vaughn's summary judgment on this issue. And I want to make this point here at oral argument because we didn't make it clearly in our briefs, and that is that in reviewing their briefs in the underlying case in preparation for this argument, it's clear to me that they never raised the issue of a lack of genuine issue of material fact at the trial court on this issue. We moved for summary judgment on this issue that all of our costs would be allocable to post-83 years because that's the liability for which we were seeking coverage, liability for damage post-83. And Judge Vaughn agreed with us that even if we paid money into a settlement facility which distributed money to a bunch of claimants, including some claimants that had installations pre-1983, that we were still paying on account of our own liability. They argued the merits in below, but they didn't argue that there was no genuine issue of material fact, and now they're in their papers here, they're ginning up issues of material fact that they say precluded summary judgment, and I think it's unfair under the Supreme Court rules. I don't think they should be permitted to raise that for the first time here when they didn't raise it below. But secondly, the reality is that Judge Vaughn found clearly, and he enunciated in his 2006 opinion, that all of the monies that we paid were on account of our own liability, not on account of the liability of any other defendant in these PB cases.
Thank you. Let me go back to the first issue, which obviously is a thorny issue for the court. The first point I would make is that my opponent assiduously avoids the fact that DuPont needed to trigger two policy periods in order to get coverage. As I said, 55.6% of the claims don't trigger the 1985 period. They trigger the 1986 period.
Well, it would be helpful if you could just articulate the rule you'd like our court to announce, because when you made your opening remarks, you seemed to suggest that if the settlement had been structured in a lump some way, maybe the result in this case would have been different.
Yeah.
And earlier you said the results should be the same whether you settle or whether you go to litigation in two separate years.
Yeah, I think we've gotten bogged down in this lump sum versus coverage in place. The rule is, and I'll say it again because this is pretty significant stuff, is that we only ask the court to rule that agreed allocations to a settlement period bind the policyholder in subsequent dealings with insurers in other years where the policyholder has accessed the coverage in the settlement period by negotiating an agreement that allocates specific amounts to the settlement period for the purpose of first exhausting any self-insured retentions in the underlying coverages and then obviously for payment by the insurer. The rule actually, although we do talk about it as coverage in place in our reply brief, we understand that it's not limited to coverage in place agreements. It applies to any lump sum payment or any coverage in place agreement so long as that agreement requires the policyholder to, as that would under a policy, to first exhaust the underlying SIR and the underlying coverages, if any.
So if we adopt that rule, parties could then negotiate themselves out of its application, depending on how they wrote their settlement.
That is indeed a possibility, depending on how the settlements are entered into. The reason that ACE required that is that ACE says, I'm not going to pay you a penny. I sit above $125 million. You've got to prove to me that there's $125 million that you paid, $50 million out of your own pocket, and then that XL paid $75 million. In this case, obviously, XL only paid $67.5 million, and so the difference DuPont has to make up out of its own pocket. And what ACE was telling them is that I'm not going to pay you a penny until you exhaust. And that is the fundamental difference between what happened in that the post-1986 period and what happened in the other policy periods with regard to settlements. We presume, again, we haven't seen the 83 or 84 settlements, but we presume that to be a fact.
Aren't you really saying that whenever there is a claim over more than 1 year and there are retentions for all the years that are applicable, one retention, by definition, as a matter of law, has to be deemed assigned to the settlement, and one retention, as a matter of law, has to stay with the policy year chosen by the insured?
In effect, that's what we're claiming. The difference here, I think, is that we don't have a situation in which we're jointly and severally liable for a whole slew of the claims that fall within the 86 period. As I said again, the 86 period covers stuff that our policies don't. It covers the majority of the claims that our policies don't. Accordingly, in order to trigger coverage and obtain coverage in 1986, they needed to take a $50 million SIR before they could get that coverage. In order to get coverage from us, they need to take a separate $50 million SIR. The bottom line on this is that if they had litigated it to judgment, they clearly would have had to take two $50 million SIRs, and there is no principled basis by which you would not require them to do so just because they entered into these coverage in place agreements.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.